Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein. This is the Responsible Day for the 8th of Kislev. Today we're going to learn Shut Da'at Kohen from the Yerodea section, Shut Da'at Kohen, which are response on Yerodea issues. It's from Simon Kuf Tzadi Gimel, response from 199. It is dated, the 8th of Kislev of Ayin Tov Reish Vav, which was 1915. I think it's Rav Kook is stuck during World War I, is stuck outside of Eretz Yisrael, but I'm not positive. In any case, he's writing to the chief rabbi, to a rabbi in Basel, Switzerland. This rabbi in Basel, Switzerland had a case where there was a wealthy man in a certain community, I think in Basel, a wealthy man in Basel, who violated Yom Kippur. How did he violate Yom Kippur? He ate, he drank, he had a good breakfast, good lunch, whatever it was. Everybody knows about this. He opened his store, he did malacha, he drove to shul, whatever he did. He violated Yom Kippur in all the ways one could violate Yom Kippur, and then brought Maftir Yonah. Let's remember that Maftir Yonah is the Haftarah that said at Mincha. It is the entire book of Yonah. And so this man, whatever the story backstory was, he had a perfectly fine Yom Kippur in terms of not keeping it, meaning he didn't fast, and he violated the day also in terms of its malachot, in terms of the prohibited actions on Yom Kippur. Then he comes to shul and he buys Maftir Yonah. So this rabbi had decided to punish the shul by shunning them, saying that unless they were to fine or in otherwise punish this person who had bought the Maftir Yonah, and the way that they were supposed to do it was by telling him he can't get an aliyah la Torah anymore. He can't get aliyot for a certain number of years. And this rabbi said he wouldn't come and give a drush in there. He wouldn't come and speak in that shul. There's a lot to be said about this, but it's a relatively long tshuva for this time slot that we have. So I'm going to try, and I have other digressions that I'm going to feel compelled to make. So I'm going to limit this one, but I would just point out that for all that this man drives or in otherwise violates Yom Kippur and eats and drinks on Yom Kippur, Rav Kook assumes, and this rabbi assumes, that he would feel punished by being denied getting aliyot, which is an interesting cultural comment. Might be true today as well, but it's an interesting cultural comment on people and what they value and what matters to them. And this rabbi also seems to assume, and perhaps correctly, that his saying he would not speak there anymore would be experienced by these people as a punishment. For all that they're willing to give Maftir Yonah to a man who eats and drinks in Yom Kippur, a man who drives or otherwise violates Yom Kippur in Malacha, not having a rabbi, this particular rabbi, come to them and give them drashot from time to time, that would in fact be a huge punishment. So that's the question, is it okay or not? He turns to Rav Kook to find it's okay. So Rav Kook says his first instinct is, we'll see, this is not his final instinct, but his first instinct is, if this rabbi came on a regular rotation to this shul and he spoke there, so then the problem is, you could say that he has become mishuabad, that's his job. It's part of the understanding of what he does, and therefore he has an obligation to do it. And the question of when you can break existing obligations is not so simple. Here's an example of the Gemara that talks about the fact that there's something called Yomei Dekala. Yomei Dekala, when there were public gatherings for Torah learning, and there the Gemara seems to assume that the rabbi giving the shir is mishuabad to the community on that day. On other days, he teaches what he wants to because he's the chief Torah scholar and he can set the curriculum. But on Yomei Dekala, he has to speak in certain ways to the community that gathers, and he has some level of obligation to them. More, if he refuses to come to this shul anymore, he's punishing not only the man who got Maftir Yonah, and not only, and this is an important person in this story as well, although he won't come up that often, but the man who was sort of in charge of selling Maftir Yonah, of giving Maftir Yonah out to somebody who gave it to this man, those people clearly did something wrong that they were culpable for. Them, Rav Kook seems comfortable with punishing straight up. But what about all the other people there? So he says, from the story, it sounds like only this head gabbai who sold it had the right to, was the one who was involved in the action and the choice of who gets Maftir Yonah. Him you could have punished, but all of the other innocent people in the shul, they didn't do anything. So why are you going to punish them? So he'll go on from there. I just want to point out right here that I think this is a question that would bear asking. In different times, different places, worked in different ways, but I wonder whether we too often give a pass to people we call innocent bystanders. Meaning, if everybody in the shul had yelled out when this man got Maftir Yonah and said, this is unacceptable, that a man who's violating Yom Kippur should on this day be getting a big honor, and who eats and drinks, and they made a big hubbub about it, I wonder what would have happened. I think that too often, I think this in communities, I think it's in nations, I think it's in lots of contexts. Too often, we give a pass to people and say, well, what were they going to do? And very often, it's true that if everybody took it upon themselves to protest, to say, this is unacceptable to me, things would change. It's a complicated question. You can't always be protesting everything, but... And it's not our topic today. So that's Rav Kook's initial instinct. And he therefore thinks that he has a problem here. But he does note that we have a general idea in halakha that in a place of Chilul Hashem, where there's something being done that is a sacrilege of the name of God, and people eating and drinking Yom Kippur and then being honored despite that, he is clear and he never steps back, a Chilul Hashem, something that bears us thinking about, that if we allow people who are violating the Torah, now in their times perhaps we would say they were in a shogeg, they knew what they were doing. Today we might say, oh, these people are shogeg, but the whole idea of honoring people on the day they violate something, after they violate Yom Kippur, it's a Chilul Hashem. In a place of Chilul Hashem, so then we have the right to step outside of Torah bounds and give punishments the Torah itself doesn't give. So there's no Torah punishment that says deny people shiurim, deny people speeches on Torah topics. There is no such thing. But where there's a Chilul Hashem, then it's in the power of Rabbanim, of leaders of the Jewish people, to administer punishments that aren't particularly specifically prescribed by the Torah. The problem, though, is that's true of the person who committed the crime, who did the wrong thing. So those people were allowed to punish in ways that the Torah itself might not have prescribed. And that's where they say, so we have a case in the Gemara of a person who rode a horse on Shabbat, and they brought it to Beit Din and they killed him, even though riding a horse on Shabbat is not a biblical prohibition of the Torah. And it's not clear that there was the full complement of witnesses and warning, all those things, but everybody knew that he had done it. And they killed him. The Gemara says it's not because halachically that's the punishment that goes for that. In that time and in that place, that court decided that it was necessary. So Rav Kook is clear that that's true. So if a whole community had done something that was a Chilul Hashem, and this rabbi thought that until they rectify their Chilul Hashem, they needed to be punished in a way the Torah itself doesn't prescribe, and said, I'm not speaking to you on Torah topics. I'm not coming to honor you with my presence, however that works, until you rectify it, Rav Kook seems not to have would not have had a problem with that, even though there is no such punishment established in the Torah. Problem is, that's for the person who's committed the act, who has done the Chilul Hashem. So in our case, there's the person who ate and drank, the man who ate and drank and then got Mafter Yonah, right? The man who violated Yom Kippur and then got an honor, and there was the man maybe who gave him the honor or let him buy the honor. But what about everybody else? To punish everybody else who didn't do it. So he says, Shalo chat'u klal zo lo shamanu, who didn't sin at all, that we never heard of. So that question, didn't sin at all, I think, again, bears thinking about. In any case, he says, so maybe I can tell you there's a taz in Choshen Mishpat that might support this claim of Rav Kook, he says. Taz in Choshen Mishpat says that if the Torah ever says explicitly that we're allowed to do something, to be mekel, to be lenient about an issue, then even though Chachamim have generally the right to be machmir on certain things, the Chachamim can make rules, can make prohibitions, and can make things to help the Torah be protected and to make sure that we are, our observance is what it should be. The Taz held that if the Torah says explicitly you're allowed to do something, then Chazal couldn't tell us we're not allowed to, even if they're doing it explicitly for the purpose that they think in our time and place it's necessary to make a new rule. That's what the Taz held, if it's explicit. So, therefore, you might have said that there's a prohibition in the Torah to punish people who weren't involved in a crime. And you get it from, the Torah says, Lo yimtu avot al banim, you can't kill fathers for the sins of their sons, and vice versa. And if you can't kill relatives, then obviously you can't kill or otherwise punish, Rav Kook is saying, bystanders, strangers. People weren't involved in this at all, and therefore you'd say that Chachamim don't even have the right to do it in such cases. As the Tazit said it from Lo Lavor al Divrei Torah, that the Chazal's right to punish people or to make ordinances or make rules beyond the Torah to protect the Torah is as long as it's not Lavor al Divrei Torah. And the Taz held Lavor al Divrei Torah, to transgress the Torah included anything the Torah explicitly said. So the Torah explicitly says this should never happen. Therefore, it would seem that you can't do it. And he suggests that's why the Gemara rereads the story of Achan and Yehoshua, where the verses themselves seem like Achan's children were killed as well. Gemara wonders how the children could have been killed when, after all, they didn't do anything wrong. And the Gemara says, no, it wasn't to kill them. It was to show them what was happening so they would know what had gone on. So whether or not that's the literal pshat, it would support the Taz's idea and the idea that Rav Kook is promoting, that bystanders, people who are not implicated in whatever the crime was, can't be punished, even in a situation where we're going to go beyond the letter of the Torah for protective purposes, where the courts will have the right to do that. They can nonetheless not do that in terms of other people who weren't implicated in the original crime. Now that's a complicated case there, because the Gemara uses that verse in the Torah of Lo Yimtu Avad Banim elsewhere for a whole another general principle, the idea that relatives cannot give testimony for or against each other. So if you're going to use the pasuk for that, then it seems like this whole idea that it really means we don't kill them for the sins of the victim. So Rav Kook says, for all that the Gemara uses a pasuk for some, this is an important principle you'd want to apply elsewhere too, maybe, and think about where it does or doesn't apply. For all that the Torah, that the Gemara, the Torah Shebe'al Alpeh, the oral law, says that a verse has implications that are not the simplest ones, it doesn't mean you can ignore the simplest ones. The simplest ones also apply, at least here. So therefore, when it says, Loyim tu avor al banim, it means A, like the Torah Shebapel tells us that relatives can't give testimony, but also B, like its original meaning, that we're not allowed to kill people for the sins of their relatives. And he says, there are people who don't like the oral law, and then they want to say the oral law is unauthentic, already in Rav Kook's time, already in 1915. And such people would say, you know, the Torah, the Gemara says, the verse, Lehim Tu'avod al-Banim, is talking about testimony and whether relatives can give testimony against each other. They say that's very strange, because in Melachim Bet, in chapter 14, there's a pasuk that talks about Amatzia is killing certain people. He kills the people who, he kills the, Amatzia took the throne after there was a rebellion against his father that had killed his father. So Amatzia puts to death the people who had killed his father, the king. But the verse goes out of his way to say, but he didn't kill, and this is in contrast, actually, if you look it up, to get us to the Northern Kingdom. In the Northern Kingdom, when one set of kings wants to take over from another, and they wipe out the entire royal family. So here, too, you might have imagined that he would wipe out the entire family of the rebels. The verse goes out of its way to say, he didn't do it. He killed the rebels themselves who killed his father, but the Bnei HaMakim Lohimit. And it says in Malachim Bet, he didn't do it. Katzuv b'sefer Torat Moshe, as is written in the Torah, lo yimtu avot al banim. The fathers shouldn't be killed for the sins of the sons, and the sons not killed for the sins of the fathers. So people who sadly lack in belief in the Torah Shebaal Peh will say, see. They lack faith in the oral law, we'll say, see. The verse in Malachim shows that the way that people understood that pasuk, at least up until the time of Amatzia, which therefore would seem to contradict the claim that Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, was given at Har Sinai, at Mount Sinai, with the written law. They'll say, see, Amatzia understood it in the simple way. He didn't know that it was about a testimony and relatives and things like that. So Rav Kook says, they don't know what they're talking about, right? It's both. It, when the oral law reads a pasuk in a certain way for halachic purposes, that doesn't mean that it gets rid of the pshat. So the pshat of Lehim Tu Avor Al Banim, that we don't kill sons for the sins of their fathers or vice versa, that's true as well. And it supports our idea, Rav Kook's idea, that you don't punish bystanders as well, because here's Amatzia, he's a king. He could have decided that it's necessary to kill the children as well to throw a fright to people and to make sure that people know that you're not allowed to kill kings, and that's a violation of the Torah, and to get that message across. But nonetheless, he doesn't do it, and he doesn't do it for the reason that the Torah says you're not allowed to do it, supporting Rav Kook's idea that that pasuk means that we're not allowed to punish people who weren't involved in the original crime, even if that punishment will help support and help promote better observance of the Torah. Except, so first of all, Rav Kook isn't so sure that we can follow this Taz, because he thinks that the Taz doesn't necessarily fit in cases where we're doing it lemegdar milt. I mean, the Taz was talking about where Chazal is just making rules, but if they're specifically making it in a particular situation because there's some pressing need, he's not sure that we would have to follow that Taz. But there's also a case that goes against it. And the case that goes against it is the case in the Givonim. There's a case in Shmuel where the Givonim feel that Sheol had mistreated them. And therefore, they wanted children of Shaul to mistreat themselves to get revenge. And it's all a big story there, and it's a big problem. And that's one of the reasons why we think the Givonim never really fit into the Jewish people, even though they sort of converted, because they don't display the quality of Rachmanim, of compassion. And they just take these seven, you know, descendants of Shaul, and they kill them, and they mistreat them, and they leave them out in public to make a point about how Shaul had mistreated them. But David, for whatever reason, you can look it up, David, for whatever reason, feels he has to go along. And so the Gemara says, I don't understand. We don't kill children for the sins of their fathers. And then the Gemara's answer is, Umishane mutav she'teaker ot achat min haTorah v'lo yitchalel shem shamayim b'farhesya. Better to uproot a principle of the Torah than to allow a chil Hashem in public, which sounds like, if it's a matter of chil Hashem, what we're trying to do is avoid, and the chil Hashem there would have been the chil Hashem that Shaul would get away with mistreating people, and that, oh, just because he's a king, just because he's powerful, he can step on people when he's not really allowed to. So to avoid that chil Hashem, people being able to say that, David had the right and the necessity of appeasing the Givonim in this way that really shouldn't have happened. So that sounds like, if you have a chil Hashem going on, you can transgress the issue of lo yintuv ad al panim, and you can punish people if it's necessary. You can even punish people who aren't liable, who aren't obligated, who weren't implicated in the original sin, like these descendants of Shaul's who had not been implicated in the sin, nonetheless you could. And Rav Kook thinks you can transfer that to the proper degree to other punishments as well. That if there's a chil Hashem in public, we're allowed to even do things that will punish, to whatever extent necessary, those who really shouldn't have been considered part of the original act, and therefore theoretically shouldn't have been part of the punishment. We are allowed to do it because of this, for the sake of avoiding chil Hashem. Then Rav Kook throws in there, you might have thought that that's different because the Gemara's tradition was that David picked the children of Shaul to give over by passing them in front of the Aron Kodesh, passing them in front of the Ark, and the Ark would sort of take in those who weren't to be punished and would leave aside those who were to be punished. And so therefore you could say, well, David HaMelech had divine imprimatur, had divine agreement to doing this, so maybe that's why. Maybe in general we cannot do this, but in that situation he was allowed to do this. So there Rav Kook takes a position, at least in this tshuva and this responsum, based on a Tosfot in Yevamot, and it's a very interesting Tosfot, but it makes a very far-reaching claim about the powers of a Navi that is not his full topic. He just throws it in as three lines, as a few lines, and therefore we're not going to spend all that much time on it, but that is a striking thing. He says that what we're allowed to do based on the insight of a Navi, based on the claims of a Navi, a prophet comes and says, Hashem told me to do this or this or this, he says that's only the same level as a Beit Din, as a court. So he means, I think, that whatever a Navi tells us we can do, and we can do it, we could do it based on a court as well. The reason why he says that is because in the case of Eliyahu on Har HaKarmel, on Mount Carmel, so there, on Mount Carmel, Eliyahu offered sacrifices outside the Beit HaMikdash, which is against the Torah, and the well-known answer is that it's called the Hora'at Sha'ah. So Tosfot in Yevamot assumes that the Hora'at Sha'ah, the rule that Eliyahu made for the moment that said, I have the right now, in order to help further observance, to violate the Torah, that rule, you might have thought, is only for prophets, because he says, I had a prophet that told me, I have God who told me that. So the Tosfot there said that the Gemara says we should learn from that as a general principle that we're allowed to do these things. So Tosfot says it shows, he thinks, that a Navi and a court have the same status for tzorech sha'ah, for things that are their momentary need, they have the same exact status, which is a far-reaching claim. He doesn't go through whether the majority of authorities agree with this. It's a line in the Tosfos. But Rav Kook here seems to assume that it's true, that anything that a Beit Din can't do, he says it the other way, anything that a Beit Din can't do, a Navi can't do. Whereas I think Tosfos really said it first the positive way. Anything a Navi can do, then a Beit Din should be able to do, a court should be able to do, and yet he takes the other way and says, no, there would be limitations on it. So if we say that you can't do it too, so with David, if it would have been true that we think in general, this is what he's saying, if in general the courts are not allowed to punish innocent people, bystanders, for the sake of avoiding public chil Hashem, then David should have been able as well. So the fact that David did it on the basis of the Aron, the Ark, showing him who should or shouldn't be done it, doesn't mean that David is an exception. It has to be revelatory about what could have been true for a court as well. And therefore, it seems to be that David teaches us that, in fact, there are occasions when we are allowed to punish for the necessity of avoiding Chilul Hashem. We're allowed to punish even those people who haven't done anything wrong to the degree, only to the degree, absolutely necessary. Another example that is that the halach in Yoredeya, Shin Lamed Daled, says that a court can decide if it's necessary, if somebody's sinning in public, they have no way to stop that person from sinning, they can decide to expel his children from school. So this is a topic that today comes up sometimes as well, and people are horrified by the idea of it. How would you punish the children? The children did nothing, so, which is absolutely true, right? Everybody agrees to that fundamental statement. Rav Kook points out, it's halacha in Shulchan Aruch that you're allowed to, if it's necessary, to discipline an over avera, a sinner. And the Taz, and this name of the Maharshal there, says, how can you do it? And also, there were occasions when you could kick the wife out of the man out of shul, you certainly could kick, but you can kick the wife out of shul as well. And the idea is, by bringing pressure on the family, that might bring pressure on the man himself. He might not care that he's kicked out of shul. He might not care that he doesn't get aliyot, but he might care that his kids can't go to school. He might care that his wife is kicked out of shul, even though she hasn't done anything well. So the Maharshal says, I don't understand. She didn't do anything wrong. And the Taz says, I don't understand. I don't understand what he doesn't understand about it. And he says, well, the Maharshal meant that if it's an adult, maybe you can. But in any case, you have that discussion over there. So if Cook thinks that the end result is that for most sins, we're not allowed to punish bystanders, people who weren't themselves sinners in this situation. That's why the Gemara asked the question about Achan, and that's how you could kill the children. And the Gemara therefore said, you didn't kill the children, you just taught them a lesson by having them be standing there. So that seems to conclude, in fact, that we don't punish the children for the fathers because of the pasuk lo yimtu avot al banim. That would be expanded easily to other bystanders as well. The exception being, Rav Kook says, he thinks it's clear from the case of David and Givonim, the exception being chilul shem shamayim b'farhesya, public chilul Hashem. With public chilul Hashem, we have support for the idea that we punish whoever needs to be punished, not because they did something, but whoever needs to be punished in order to make the point that will get us back to a place where the chilul Hashem, this sad sacrileging of God's name, will have been addressed as it needed to be so that it won't happen again in these kinds of ways. That would mean, therefore, that this rabbi who said he's going to punish the whole shul, so that would be okay. It seems like it's right because he's reacting to a chilul Hashem. Then he also suggests another idea is that really what this rabbi meant to do was punish the head guy, the man who gave Maftir Yonah to this sinner. He's in charge of arranging all these things. And that really what the rabbi who's saying, I can't come speak there anymore, was saying, well, if you're the leader of this congregation and you're the one making decisions of this congregation, I can't come to be part of something that you run. And that's the central focus of what he's planning on doing. Rav Kook says, in that situation, if your central focus is the sinner, and the man who gave Maftir Yonah to this person who had eaten on Yom Kippur and had also violated Yom Kippur in Malacha, that's who he's being punished. The fact that there are collateral damage, Rav Kook says, that might be allowed also. I think that might even be more broadly allowed because you're not necessarily required, to make sure that in every punishment you give, there's no collateral damage, which is also a broad idea that applies in many situations. And you can hear people today who will say, oh, if you do that, you're going to be punishing so-and-so who didn't do anything. So Rav Kook is saying a second part of that answer would be, if the primary addressee of my action is a person who is culpable for whatever they did, who does deserve whatever punishment is being administered, and in this case it's the leader, meaning it'll be embarrassing for this leader to be the man on whose watch the chief rabbi of Basel said, I can't come to this shul anymore. And that's his basic point. And so his basic point was, so meaning maybe if this man was removed from his leadership position and then the next leader who came in would react to the situation as was supposed to be, then this chief rabbi would be able to come back. Because the man who came into power would say, okay, the man who got Maftir Yonah last year can't get Aliyot anymore until he makes amends for what he did. Or he can't get Aliyot for some period of time to punish him for what he did. So that would be fine. So that's what Rav Kook is saying. That you can read this reaction of this rabbi as being addressed at the leadership of the shul. And if the leadership changes, then the situation will change. This is a topic that can be very contemporary as well, as to when leadership needs to change, how leadership needs to respond to things that they did wrong, but we'll leave that for another time. He bases this idea on a Gemara in Sukkah. The Gemara in Sukkah talks about where various families of Kohanim would divide the korbanot, the sacrifices, or the parts of sacrifices that had come to them. And the Gemara there says that Bilga, that most families would divide up what they got in the north. Right? In the northern part of the Azara, that was where you divided up pieces of the korbanot, the sacrifices that were going to go to Kohanim, to the priests and their families sometimes. That would be done in the northern part of the Azara. But they had a tradition, the family of Bilga would always do it in the southern part of the Azara. So why was that? Because this family of Bilga had a case. There was a woman named Miriam Bat Bilga, and she left Judaism, which apparently happens, unfortunately, maybe a different percentage, different extents, but it's happened throughout Jewish history. She left Judaism, and then when the Yevanim, when the Greeks came into, I think prior to Hanukkah, when they came into the sanctuary and they defiled it there before the Maccabim fought back and cleansed it, she, having joined them already, she took her shoe and she banged it on the Mizbeach and she said terrible things, that she blasphemed, she did all sorts of terrible things. And when the Chachamim heard about it, they took away from the family of Bilga their place in the north of Israel. They had a ring. They used to slaughter these animals. They put their necks through a ring to hold it in place while they did the Shrita. They closed up that ring. They got rid of their place in there, and they didn't have a place anymore. So when they had to divide up their korbanot, their sacrifice, they'd do it in the southern part of the Azarah. That was where they had room to do it. So the Gemara says, that was one answer for why this family of Bilga had to do it in the south. The other answer is unimportant for us. But the Gemara says about this answer, because she did one thing wrong, we're going to pass it, we're going to rule it, we're going to punish him and his whole family. So Amar Abaye, Kedamar Inche, Shuta di Yenuka Beshuka, Oda Avua Oda Ime. And Rashi explains, it's what people say that when a child speaks in the marketplace, they heard it from the family. So therefore, if she left religion and said terrible things, we think it's in the family. It's in her parents as well. So they say, so because of her parents, we punish the whole family, the whole mishmaret, the whole group. So Abaye says, Oy l'rasha, oy l'shcheino, tol tzadik, tol l'shcheino. Yes, sometimes you get punished by who you associate with. And if you associate with the wrong people and punishment comes to them, it comes to you as well. So Rav Kook says, that shows you, right? The Oy l'rasha, oy l'shcheino says, yeah, I can't go ahead and punish somebody directly for something they didn't do, but if they're the neighbor of somebody I'm punishing, and therefore the punishment that comes to them, meaning, let's say for whatever reason, a person deserves to have their house destroyed by the Beit Din, right? For a Megder Milta, for not as a pure legal thing, but as a protective measure. You can imagine the neighbors all saying, it's not fair to us, it's going to ruin our property values, we've got a big hole in the block now. And I say, what happened there? You say, oh, so-and-so was there, and it got destroyed by the Beit Din. It's going to destroy our property values. That's Oy l'rasha, oy l'shcheino, and Rav Kook is applying that here. You go to that shul, it's too bad on you. So you'll say, well, but I didn't do anything. So the answer is, well, it's too bad on you because you're in that shul, and therefore the punishments that come to the head of the shul will come to you. A way around it, as I implied before, would be if you got rid of the head of the shul, put in a new head of the shul, it could be changed. But in any case, he throws in another interesting last piece. He says, I don't even know why the Gemara had to go this far, because after all, we just said, in case of Chil Hashem, then you can punish other people just for the sake of it, right? This would seem to go against that because she, this Miriam Bat Bilga, committed a terrible Chilul Hashem. She banged with her sandal, her shoe, on the Mizbeach. She said terrible things. It's Chilul Hashem. So why did we have to reach for, right? It almost sounds like his first reasoning isn't correct, because if his first reason was correct, the answer should have been, we punish whoever we need to punish in case of Chilul Hashem. So he says another novel idea that I'm not sure we all recognize. He says it's only a Chilul Hashem if the person acting in a certain way is still part of the Jewish people. But this Miriam, who had already left the Jewish people, had already married a Greek, so whatever she says doesn't qualify as a Chil Hashem anymore in terms of Jews, because she's not part of the people anymore, she's not part of the religion anymore, and therefore it all comes back into play that it could all work out the way that he said. So that's another extremely important and interesting idea, that if somebody has left the religion, what they do doesn't qualify as a Chilul Hashem. So Rav Kook has taught us at least three important ideas. Idea number one, he said, place a Chilul Hashem, the public Chilul Hashem. He thinks you're allowed to punish not only the people implicated, people involved, but you can punish whoever needs to be punished in order to address the Chilul Hashem and rectify it. That would mean that even if we think of the people in the shul, the ordinary people in the shul is completely innocent in this situation, because that's necessary to react properly to the chilul Hashem, they can be punished. Idea number two, it might be that whether or not that's true, it might be that when punishing people who have done something wrong, you're allowed to punish the people, and if that has some impact on other people, if they weren't the main focus of the action, you don't have to worry about that. That's the problem of or the Rashav or Yishchino. And then the third issue of the idea that Chilul Hashem only emanates from those who are still considered part of the believing Jewish community. If they've left the believing Jewish community, then they're not part of that. Their actions can't qualify as a chilul Hashem, such as those of Miriam Bat Bilga. So he goes on a little bit further, but we're running out of time, and that's really the backbone of the tshuva, that this is what the rabbi can do. I think he does recommend that the rabbi think carefully about whether that's necessary and what kind of punishment is what's going to be most effective, but that fundamentally he agrees with him that he can do what's necessary to make sure that chilul Hashems don't happen anymore. And that is the responsibility for Rav Kook from the 8th of Kislev, how we respond to and who we allow ourselves to punish when it comes to chilul Hashem and to other issues, who gets punished and where innocent bystanders stand on these kinds of issues. Have a great day.